Blog Talk Radio. Greetings, this is Abayomi Ezekwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. Welcome back to this special edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. Today is Sunday, September 7th, 2014. We are broadcasting live from our studios here in downtown Detroit. This program is brought to you by the Pan-African Radio Network. And in this week's program, we'll be coming up a little bit later on with our regular Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. Also, we will run an edition of the New York City version of the Pan-African Journal, hosted by Abayomi Ezekwe and produced by Bernard White of Community Progressive Radio. And we'll be right back with more of this week's program.
Amina, amin, amin.
Greetings once again. This is Abayomi Ezekwe, and welcome back to the Pan-African Journal for this week. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, an audio news magazine brought to you here from our studios in downtown Detroit. And today is Sunday, September 7th, 2014. And we'll be right back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week.
Porque al lado de otra gente, solo por saber quién es.
Welcome back. This is Abayomi Ezekwe. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal. We just heard the music of Orchestra Baobab with the tune entitled Homage to Tonton Fore. And before that, we heard Orchestra Baobab and another tune entitled De More War. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal. If you want to have access to this program, as well as other programs from the archived vaults of the Pan-African Journal, all you have to do is log on to our website at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. In logging on to that website, you can have access to the 400 other broadcasts from the Pan-African Radio Network, produced by Abayomi Ezekwe here at the Pan-African Journal. We'll be right back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week. Thank you.
canela. Vale fuma, vale 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 canela.
Parta di ma.
Vale fuma, vale canela.
Mimi di ma.
Vale fuma, vale canela.
Mare di ma.
Vale fuma, vale canela.
Vai mufalo.
Vale fuma, vale canela.
Chundela.
Vale fuma, vale canela.
Vai mufalo.
Vale fuma, vale canela.
Welcome back. This is Abayomi Ezekwe. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal. And in this week's Pan-African Journal, we'll be coming up with our regular Pan-African Newswire reports. We would like to focus on this Pan-African Newswire on some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day. And we will, of course, be focusing on developments in Africa, in the African diaspora, and indeed the international community in general. And also, a little bit later on in our program, we'll be bringing you a archived edition of the Pan-African Journal New York City version that is hosted by yours truly and produced by Bernard White of Community Progressive Radio in New York City. So please stay tuned. And, of course, we'll be right back with more of this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal.
he walked away with tears in his eyes. I felt every pain that he felt. I cried every tear that he cried. Mama, why?
Greetings once again. This is Abayomi Ezekwe. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. And today is Sunday, September the 7th, 2014. We're broadcasting live from our studios here in downtown Detroit. And right now we want to move into our regular Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. And in this week's segment of the Pan-African Newswire, we will focus on, first of all, the unfolding political developments in the Southern African nation of Lesotho. And according to a news analysis written by Lizelle Lowe-Vaudron, it indicates that Lesotho shots rang out in the capital of the Mountain Kingdom last weekend. Many were wondering why interference in politics by the Lesotho army is such a recurring occurrence in the country, according to the analysis written by Lowe-Vaudron. Of the 15 member states of the Southern African Development Community, SADC, the small country of Lesotho is the one which has proven to be most prone to coups and attempted coups. Analysis say largely unchecked military and complicated electoral system that lends itself to personal rivalry could be at the root of the problem. Andre Rao, a senior researcher at the Institute for Security Studies in Pretoria, says a small army led by a handful of generals who have become a law unto themselves in Lesotho is a, quote, classic recipe for a coup, end quote. Add the lack of training and insufficient civilian oversight of the Lesotho Defense Forces, and this is a volatile mix that could easily lead to instability. He says the politicization of the army has been evident in Lesotho in the last few months. Now, Army Chief Lieutenant General Kladi Kamodi had, in fact, publicly threatened Prime Minister Thomas Thabane several times since the beginning of the political strife among the coalition partners in the country earlier this year. His sacking by Thabane last week is considered to be one of the reasons for the latest unrest. Quote, you have the appointment of a new chief of staff and the incumbent is visibly unhappy about it, unquote, says Rao. Those siding with Thabane, however, say that the army's intervention this time is linked to Thabane's anti-corruption drive. Thabane's political rival, Deputy Prime Minister Motejoa Metsing, appeared in court last month on charges of corruption, which he claims are unfounded and part of a smear campaign against him. The meddling by the military and politics in Lesotho can be compared with that of several smaller West African states that regularly fall victim to coup d'etats, says Raoul. Now, of the member states of the Economic Community of West African States, only Senegal has never experienced a coup in its post-colonial history. Seu Lekani, director of the Transformation Center in Maseru, Lesotho, the capital, says professionalizing the military and drawing up a legal framework for military appointments was part of reforms instituted in the early 1990s in Lesotho. This was somewhat successful, but was eroded when a fraught electoral system led to the political crisis in 1998. South Africa then intervened in the face of a military coup, and more than 60 people were killed, including 8 South African soldiers. Peklani, who is also a research fellow at the South African Institute for International Affairs, says following the 1998 crisis, a new electoral model that combines the traditional constituency-based first past the post-electoral system with a proportional system was adopted. Quote, the constituency-based system does lead to more accountability to voters in a specific area, but it excludes smaller voices in parliament because it eliminates all those who lose out to the ultimate winner, unquote, he says. Now, Lesotho has about 15 active political parties, said Pekani. The current instability came about following elections in 2012 when the Democratic Congress, the DC, the party of former Prime Minister Patalita Musididi, received the biggest number of seats in parliament, but smaller parties clubbed together to form a majority. The coalition partners, Tabani's All Basotho Convention, Metsing's Lesotho Congress for Democracy, and the smaller Basotho National Party, soon fell out, leading to all sorts of infighting. On June 11th, an agreement was signed between the LCD and the DC. This created the likelihood of Tabani's being voted out by a motion of no confidence, and he subsequently asked King Letsia III for permission to suspend parliament. The suspension was granted for a period of up to 9 months. Peklani says the suspension was legal, according to Lesotho's constitution, and had been used twice in the past for shorter periods to ensure the speedy promulgation of legislation. Members of the Lesotho Coalition traveled to New Zealand in July of this year, sponsored by the Commonwealth, to study the mixed electoral system in that country, one of the few systems in the world similar to that of Lesotho. Peklani, however, says the trip had been planned before the suspension of parliament in June and was not directly linked to the collapse of the coalition. Now, according to Lesotho Prime Minister Tom Tabani, who was escorted back into the country earlier last week by the South African police, according to an article in the South African Mail and Guardian, Prime Minister Tabani says foreign forces are keeping the peace following the attempted coup inside the country. The South Africa Mail and Guardian article goes on to say that embattled Lesotho Prime Minister Tom Tabani admitted to feeling much safer in the presence of South African police services and intelligence agency personnel. Tabani is back in his country's top seat thanks to foreign security agencies from the Republic of South Africa. Quote, it is the police and the element of the intelligence services, unquote, Tabani said in a telephone interview with the Mail and Guardian on Thursday afternoon. Quote, they are not only around my residence, they are all over the country and in police stations where there is instability, unquote, he said. But he is still the boss of Lesotho, he said. Quote, I'm in charge of the country. I am at the State House now. The only difference is that at the gate it is South Africans, but they will leave as soon as things are stable, unquote. Although he failed to convince President Jacob Zuma to send the South African National Defense Forces to secure his leadership of Lesotho, he said he was satisfied that he was receiving assistance from South Africa. Tabani, who was escorted home by South African police and a delegation of politicians chosen by the government of South Africa on Tuesday, said he hoped to have his own country's police and army returning to their duties of securing the country soon. Quote, "We need to move fast because the mission here is for a limited period, just to pave the way for us to reopen Parliament and bring things back to normal," unquote. Tapane fled to South Africa for 3 days after fleeing his country before dawn last Saturday, when it became clear the army would try to topple him. But on Thursday, he said agreements reached through the mediation of the Southern African Development Community in Pretoria on Monday were already being implemented. Quote, "I just had a meeting with the Speaker of Parliament, and he is looking at the logistics and the date of reopening Parliament," unquote, he said. Quote, "It is very quiet in the country, and it is very quiet for me also where I am staying. There are no people coming in and out like they would do normally, but this is necessary because there is a security threat," unquote. Tabani admitted that it was wrong for political parties in Lesotho to allow the police and the army to get involved in politics. Lesotho police supports Tabani, whereas the army supports Deputy Prime Minister Motshwa Metsing and the Lesotho Congress for Democracy, a coalition partner with Tabani's All Basotho Convention and the Basotho National Party led by Tasidi Maserebani. Quote, "We have had a bit of a tainted past. We had started on a good note when we got independence from the British, adopting a democratic system of separating politics and security agencies," unquote, Tabani said. Quote, "But at some point, we had a state of emergency when the party that lost elections used the army. That culture of having politicians making those mistakes is the one that brought us here," unquote. Tabani admitted he had been caught off guard by last week's attempted coup. Quote, "I must confess, it took me by surprise. It came as an unpleasant surprise because I thought we had been engaging on issues that we disagreed on," unquote, he said. "I am very disappointed," he continued. He did concede, however, that there was a, quote, "built up," unquote, towards a possible coup over the past 6 months as coalition partners struggled through one disagreement after another. Although there is a widespread doubt about how long the shaky coalition could hold, Tabani issued that only after the elections in 2017 with the government of Lesotho changed. In spite of the tension, Tabani's coalition partners governing the country had little choice but to swallow their pride and put the country first. Quote, "The trust is not negotiable. You have to carry on the work. As coalition partners, we don't have to kiss each other. There are agreements and principles, and if those principles are adhered to, we can run a clean government," unquote. Asked whether he regretted suspending Parliament in June and taking decisions on his own instead of with his coalition partners, which contributed to the rising tensions in the country, he said, quote, "No, not at all. The processes that are unfolding now create a change for all partners to negotiate better." Quote, "We are all sober now. And his party is partly thanks to the suspension of Parliament," unquote. Lesotho, a mountain kingdom landlocked by South Africa, has had several coups since independence in 1966. Tabani said he is determined to change that culture. Quote, "If I live another 5 years or so, I think this should be the last incident of this kind in Lesotho. It will be like a pimple that comes on your face. When you get treated for it, it disappears, and you remain with your beautiful face," unquote. South African police officers are currently providing security for Tabani and Police Commissioner Lotatso Suana, among others. Tabani insists his chosen army commander, Lieutenant General Maoporankoa Mahau, is now the real leader of the Lesotho Defense Forces. The Prime Minister ordered Lieutenant General Chadi Kamodi to relinquish his command on the eve of last weekend's attempted coup. There was no relationship between the uprising and Kamodi's firing, Tabani said. Quote, "It is a coincidence. The reality is we have done this," fired Kamodi constitutionally, unquote. In the early hours of last Saturday, the Lesotho Army raided police headquarters and the main station that houses the police's special operations unit. Tabani's official residence was also surrounded by soldiers. Lesotho's coalition government still has 3 more years in office before the next election. Now, that was a report from the South African Mail and Guardian on current political developments in the southern African nation of Lesotho. And in the North African state of Libya, the neocolonial government said a Sudanese military transport plane bound for a Tripoli airport under control of an armed group had entered its airspace, a government statement said on yesterday, September the 6th. Quote, this work from the Sudanese state violates the sovereignty of the state of Libya and interferes with its affairs, unquote, the statement said, adding that Libya had asked the Sudanese military attaché to leave the country. Libya said the Sudanese plane had been bound for the Tripoli Matega airport and made a refueling stop in the Libya desert oasis of Kufra near the border to Sudan. Ammunition had been found loaded on that plane during an inspection at Kufra airport, it added. Quote, we, the Libyan government, firmly denounce that a Sudanese military plane has penetrated the Libyan airspace without an official permit from the Libyan government. The plane, according to them, was carrying ammunition, which had not been officially approved by the Libyan government, unquote, the statement said. The neocolonial government in Libya is in turmoil as armed groups have seized the capital of Tripoli, controlling the Matiga airport. The government have withdrawn to Tobruk in the far east of the oil-producing state. And in the Horn of Africa nation of Somalia, the commander of Somalia's Islamist organization, Al-Shabaab, confirmed on Saturday, September the 6th, that the leader of the organization was killed in a United States airstrike. Now, Abu Muhammad said the militants were meeting at an undisclosed location to pick a successor to Ahmed Abdi Godani, a senior Somali intelligence officer. A government which is backed by the United States insisted on anonymity because he is not authorized to speak to the press, said that Zakaria Ismail, who has a $3 million bounty on his head as well, is one of the candidates to succeed Godani. Godani and other al-Shabaab officials were killed by a United States airstrike just this last past Monday. They hit a car in which they were traveling. The attack took place 105 miles, that is 170 kilometers south of the capital of Mogadishu, where al-Shabaab has a military training camp. U.S. President Barack Obama confirmed on Friday, September the 5th, that Godani was killed by a United States airstrike. Godani was also known as Mukhtar Abu Sabir and was the spiritual leader of the al-Shabaab organization. The United States had offered a reward of up to $7 million for information leading to Godani's arrest. Godani had publicly claimed al-Shabaab was responsible for the deadly Westgate Mall attack in Nairobi, Kenya, that left some 67 people dead a year ago. Somalia's government said on Friday, September the 5th, that it has credible intelligence that al-Shabaab is planning attacks following the death of their leader. In a televised speech, General Khalif Ahmed Ereg, Somalia's national security minister, said possible targets include medical and educational institutions. Ereg said the government is vigilant and its armed forces are prepared to prevent such attacks. The killing of Godani was a, quote, delightful victory, unquote, said Ereg. He called on al-Shabaab elements still fighting for the organization to surrender to get a, quote, brighter future, unquote, life from the government. The implications for an al-Shabaab following Godani's death are unclear. Some analysts predict a power struggle for the leadership that could splinter the organization. Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta said on September the 6th that the United States and thanked them for killing Godani, saying his death provides, quote, a small measure of closure, unquote, for victims of the Westgate Mall attacks. Kenya's nephew and his fiancée died in that attack. The president announced last year during the conflict. And Godani, he used a number of other aliases, led the planning and was responsible for preparation of the attack on Westgate, according to Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta. Quote, we owe the United States and its soldiers our heartfelt thanks for bringing an end to Godani's career of death and destruction and finally allowing us to begin our healing, unquote, he said. He went on to say that, quote, his death is a stark reminder that those who live by the sword shall perish by the sword, unquote, President Kenyatta said. Now, al-Shabaab, has vowed revenge, and they are opposed to the presence of Kenyan defense forces in Somalian territory. Kenyan troops went to Somalia in October 2011, ostensibly at the behest of the United States, an intervention which had been planned for nearly 2 years. This is blamed for the cross-border attacks by al-Shabaab and the kidnapping of Westerners on Kenyan soil. Kenya later became part of the African Union force that is bolstering Somalia's weak United Nations-backed government against al-Shabaab's insurgency. The United States State Department declared al-Shabaab a terrorist organization in February of 2008. And with that, we're going to conclude this week's Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. And in concluding this week's Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal, we'd like to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service designed to foster intelligent discussion on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998 and has published thousands of articles and dispatches in newspapers and magazines and journals, research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. And if you want to log on to the Pan-African Newswire, all you have to do is go to the following URL, and that's at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. And by logging on to that website, you can stay abreast of some of the most breaking and relevant issues involving the African continent, the African diaspora, and indeed the international community in general. So all you have to do is log on to that website, and you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day. This is Abayomi Ezekwe. We'll be right back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week.
Party day, party night, since my baby left this town. Sun shining all day long, but the rain keep coming down. She's my life, I need her soul. Why she left, I just don't know. Party day and party night, since I sat right down and cried. Keep raining all the time, but the river is running dry. Just ain't right. I love that girl with all of my mind. Party day and party night, that's my baby, broke my heart. Searching for her everywhere, like a blind man in the dark. Come back home to me.
I hope she come back home tonight.
Welcome back. This is Abayomi Ezekwe. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal. We just heard the sound of McKinley Morganfield, better known as Muddy Waters, 40 Days and 40 Nights. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. And I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. Today is Sunday, September 7th, 2014. We're broadcasting live from our studios here in downtown Detroit. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in to the Pan-African Journal for this week. And, of course, the Pan-African Journal is brought to you here, broadcasting live from downtown Detroit. And right now, we're going to move into a audio documentary on a little-known slave rebellion that took place in 1805, not along the Atlantic coast, but in the Pacific, and the implications of this slave rebellion in 1805. So let's listen in to the audio documentary. We'll be right back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week.
Today on Against the Grain, in 1805, a remarkable slave rebellion took place, not in the Atlantic, but in the Pacific, and involving an unusual ruse. And it illustrates, argues historian Greg Brandon, something fundamental about freedom and unfreedom in the New World. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak with Greg Brandon about a story that was immortalized by Herman Melville. That's coming right up. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The modern era, we tend to assume, is the Age of Liberty, launched by the French, American, and Haitian revolutions. Yet the period following those revolutions was characterized by extensive slavery across the New World. Historian Greg Brandon suggests that this is not the contradiction it appears, and that the lack of freedom that characterizes slavery continues with us in various guises since its abolition. It's through a historic event, a slave rebellion in the Pacific Ocean that was ultimately repressed by an anti-slavery Republican, that Grandin explores the nature of freedom and bondage in his latest work, The Empire of Necessity, published by Metropolitan Books. He's also the author of Empire's Workshop and Fordlandia, and he teaches at New York University. I have the pleasure to be joined by Greg in studio. I wonder if you could begin by telling us about this incident. It was written about in a novella by Herman Melville, and you use it to tell a much broader story about slavery and the modern condition.
Well, the story that opens the book is about this remarkable slave ship uprising that takes place, actually not in the Atlantic, where we associate slavery and chattel slavery and the triangle slave trade, but in the Pacific, in the South Pacific, off the coast of Chile. And it was a group of West Africans that had been brought into Montevideo, in sister city, the Buenos Aires, marched across the Pampas, Argentina, and then over the Andes and into the Pacific, and they were put back on another ship on their way to Lima to be sold in the slave market there. And about a week out of port, they rose up and seized the ship. And they killed most of the Spaniards, including the slaver that was taking them to Lima, and they demanded to be returned to West Africa. Now, that in itself is interesting, but not particularly remarkable. There were hundreds, if not thousands, of slave ship uprisings, the most famous one in the United States, at least, being the Amistad. But what's interesting is what happened next. And what happened next is after about 50 days of sailing up and down the Chilean coast, because the Spanish captain, Benito Cedeño, didn't want to cross into the Atlantic, didn't want to make that treacherous turn around Cape Horn, and so was stalling. They came upon another ship. This ship was called the Perseverance, and it was captained by a New Englander named Amasa Delano. Now, the West Africans had two choices. They could have fought or they could have fled. Instead, though, they came up with this remarkable plan. They let the New England captain, who they didn't know the name, obviously, but he was a Massa Delano, board the ship, and they would pretend to be slaves. They would act as if they were still enslaved, and they managed to pull off this remarkable deception for over 9 hours, and just a remarkable, not just because they were successful, but because they did it under enormous hardship. They were starving. They were thirsty. They had run out of food and water. Two women had died of thirst, and two children had died of thirst. And yet, they somehow managed to stage this deception and this ruse that for 9 hours fooled a very experienced captain, New England captain.
So they pretended that they were still the enslaved servants on the ship, and they coerced the captured captain to play along.
Yes, yes. And so the main kind of axis and tension was Massa Delano trying to figure out what the relationship was between Benito Cedeño, the Spanish captain, the man who introduced himself as captain, and the person who was introduced as his personal slave, Maury. And every time that Massa Delano wanted to speak to the Spanish captain alone, the Spanish captain would beg off and say, no, anything you need to say to me, you can say in front of Maury, my personal slave. And of course it was because he was living under the threat of death, that if, you know, Maury was pretending to be his personal servant in order to keep watch and listen to the conversation.
But Delano had some sense that something was a little strange about this, right?
Yeah, he had a sense that there was something wrong. He knew that there was something not quite right about the ship. At first he thought that Benito Cedeño, who was shattered from his experience, remember, this was 50 days into being held captive by this group of West African rebels. He thought that Benito Cedeño was maybe plotting to take his ship, that maybe he was a pirate. And he was in league with the West Africans, and they were going to take his ship. But he went back and forth from being anxious and worried, and he was also anxious that maybe Benito Cedeño, representing old world Spain, thought himself too good. He also felt insecure in the face of Benito Cedeño. So it's interesting into the psychology of this New Englander. But then he grew increasingly obsessed with the relationship between Benito Cedeño and Maury, the person who was introduced as a slave but was really this rebel turned actor. So it was just this interesting portrait of the psychological portrait of this New England captain.
And then how did the story end? In actuality.
So this went on for about 9 hours, and events conspired that Massa Delano was left alone. He sent his men to a nearby island in order to fill up the water cask. He was told that the ship had run into a storm and then had got caught in the doldrums, and that's why there's no Spaniards on board, that they all either fell overboard during the storm or they were, died from fever, and he was on board by himself for a good part of the day for 9 hours, and then he was leaving. He went to leave the ship. The ruse actually worked up until the very end. He had climbed down the ladder into his boat with his away team, and they were making ready to row back to his ship, and it's at that point that Maury, who managed to pull off this deception, must have felt an enormous rush of pride that he was able to do this. And he asked Benito Cedeño, how many men does Massa Delano have on board his ship? And when Benito Cedeño said, well, 20, but most of them were on the island, and Maury said, well, good, because we'll easily take the ship tonight, and we'll use that to return to West Africa. It's at that moment that Benito Cedeño realized that his situation wasn't going to improve anytime soon, so he pitches himself overboard, and he comes crashing down in Massa Delano's boat. And it's at that moment that Massa Delano realizes that he's been the victim of this elaborately staged deception, and he rallies his men to put down the rebellion and re-enslave the West Africans.
So one of the interesting aspects to this story is this character, this person, in fact, Massa Delano, because he is someone who has ideas that are in some way contrary to the dominance of slavery at the time, right? This is someone who's a Unitarian, So tell us about his ideas and how they did or didn't influence what he then did at this point, which you mentioned, of putting down this rebellion.
So the story itself, the book itself, tells basically two storylines. One of them is the West Africans out of Africa, out of West Africa, across the Atlantic, into the Americas, across the Americas, and into the Pacific. The other one tracks Amasa Delano out of New England and as a kind of avatar of the promise of the American Revolution. He was born in Duxbury, Massachusetts, which was a town that early on gave up the kind of Calvinist gloom that, you know, one's destiny was predetermined and one's fate and where one would wind up was already decided, and embraced a much more optimistic, even radical Christianity, the idea that the world, that human beings were perfectible, that they can govern themselves, and if they can govern themselves, they can govern each other politically, as you know, this was the foundation of what was most radical of the American Revolution, the radical republicanism of the 19th century. And Amasa Delano really was of this type. He was from a region in which slavery, he was opposed to slavery, but he didn't think it was much of a problem because this was the early 1800s, and many people thought that slavery, even if they were morally opposed to it, thought it was withering away, not just in the North, where it was in fact withering away in the North, but that even in the South, that it was a problem that was a problem of the past. And what's fascinating about it is that Amasa Delano basically sails into America's future in the Pacific, this world of race, violence, and terror, and repression, and what he finds there is what would later grip the United States, you know, after the explosion of chattel slavery in the 1810s and 1820s and 1830s.
And so for him, and as you say, you sort of see him as representing something much more than just the views of an individual, but how did he reconcile, did he try to reconcile his own views on slavery and the actions that he took, which was to re-enslave these West Africans who had freed themselves?
Right. The way that I think about it is, again, thinking about these two different storylines, and one being the history of the West Africans, and one being the history of Amasa Delano. Amasa Delano really, really is a failure at most everything he does. He is he's thrust into the world by the American Revolution. The American Revolution is this world historical event that happens when he's a teenager, and he goes out in the world to make good in the world. And he's largely a failure at everything he does. He cannot redeem the promise of the American Revolution. He's a little bit of a Republican zealot. He finds himself witnessing or many of the storied events of the creation of the modern world. He's in India when at the beginning of British colonialism. He's in South Africa, witnessing the roots of Dutch, what eventually becomes apartheid. He's in the Galapagos Island before Darwin. But he's largely a failure in terms of economics. He can't quite get it together, except as a sealer, and that's what he's doing in the South Pacific. He's sealing.
Sealing meaning seal hunting.
Yes. And seal hunting is this fascinating industry, and it's really the United States' first experience with boom and bust resource extraction. I mean, we think of whaling, but whaling was a much more sustainable. We don't think of it as sustainable, but it took place over the course of decades before it really exhausted many of the whale herds. But sealing took place. The boom was in the 1790s. New Englanders like Amasa Delano found themselves in the South Pacific, and they were hunting seals. There were tens of thousands, millions of seals in rookery after rookery, island after island, beach after beach. It seemed kind of endless, and they would take seals out. They would kill the seals and bring them to Canton in China. And what began to happen, though, was there were so many seal skins being brought into China that the prices began to collapse. And within a remarkably short period of time, what you had was collapsing prices and extinction, because the only way that these sealers could make up the difference of the margins was to accelerate the killing. So Amasa Delano was there for the boom, and his very first sealing expedition in the 1790s, he did quite well. And the second expedition, though, was during the bust, and there was no seals left to kill and no money to be made. So his own crew is on the verge of mutiny. They're conspiring. They're complaining. He's resorting more and more to physical punishment in order to maintain authority. And so part of the putting down of the slave rebellion was allowed him to reestablish authority over his own crew. And this is where these two storylines, the violence of slavery and the violence of an ecological destruction as represented by Sealing, intersect and come together. And he doesn't actually ever reconcile it. He becomes, I think, quite shattered by what happens. He goes back to the United States, and he winds up his life poor and destitute, but also very jaundiced and cynical about Christianity, about the American project, and about American expansion.
And how do we know what we know about the story? As you say, you sort of trace it along a number of lines, and I want to ask you about that other thread, which is the journey of the West Africans. But Herman Melville wrote his book about half a century after this event took place. The information that we do know about what took place and how people viewed it and sort of the unfolding of events, where does that come from?
Well, it mostly comes from Amasa Delano's memoir, which he wrote as a way of to get out of debt, and he published it about a little bit over 10 years after the event itself, and that's where Melville gets the story from. Melville writes this he fictionalizes the event in this remarkable short story novella that he publishes in 1855, and he gets it all from Amasa Delano's memoir, which recounts his seagoing life, and that's published in 1816, and then Melville reads it and fictionalizes it 40 years later.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and I'm speaking with historian Greg Grandin about his new book, The Empire of Necessity, that's published by Metropolitan Books. So then there is, of course, another thread to the story that you mentioned, and that's the trajectory of the West Africans who found themselves ultimately aboard this boat and mutinied. I wonder if you can tell us what you know about the course that they took and how they experienced it.
Well, the West Africans came into the Americas in early 1804, and this was the height of what the Spaniards were calling free trade in slaves, free trade in blacks. Now, for centuries, slavery existed in the Americas since the 1500s, when the Spaniards and Portuguese set up the institution we think of as chattel slavery. But for a long time, it was tightly controlled under a system that the Spaniards called mercantilism. It was highly regulated. Only a small number of Spanish American merchants could participate in the trade. Only a small number of American port cities were allowed to import slaves, Havana, Cartagena, and whatnot. And only a small number of companies had the license, monopoly license, companies and countries to import slaves into the Americas. That begins to change in the 1770s. The Spanish crown begins to use words we would associate with today's economy. They began to deregulate the slave trade. They began to privatize the slave trade and lower tariffs and lower taxes and grant more and more people the right to engage in slavery directly, every man a slaver in some ways. I mean, Spanish-American merchants had long been demanding more free trade, more liberty to engage in economic activity, including the right to buy and sell Africans themselves, unmediated through the crown. And in response to the American Revolution, to the French Revolution, to the Haitian Revolution, Spain gradually gave in to these demands. And 1804 was by 1804, when the West Africans came into Montevideo, it was a free-for-all. More slaves came in to Montevideo, which was granted the right to import slaves under this regime of deregulation, than any year previously. This group of West Africans, or at least a portion of this group of West Africans that wind up in the Pacific, actually were headed towards the Caribbean. They were on a Liverpool slave ship, and they were intercepted by a French Jacobin pirate, privateer, who who had contractual relations with merchants in Montevideo and Buenos Aires. You know, sometimes when we think of pirates, we think of them almost as proto-anarchists, sailing the ever-free sea, enthralled to no man or no nation or no law. But in the case of Spanish America, they were vanguard merchant capitalists. They worked very directly, hand in glove, with Spanish American merchants to seize British goods, because France and Britain were at war with each other, and divert those goods into Spanish America. And by far, the most valuable good was slaves, were human beings. And these West Africans came in on this French pirate ship, this French revolutionary pirate ship, and very quickly they were transformed from contraband into commodities. They got caught up in machinations in Montevideo and Buenos Aires, which I go into detail in the book. Some of them were involved in at least two other slave ship rebellions before they were gathered together into this one lot in Montevideo and then in Buenos Aires and then shipped across the Pampas. As part of this explosion of slavery that happens in the Americas, more and more slaves were being shipped overland. I mean, there's two ways of getting to Lima. One, you can go around Cape Horn by ship. But that was expensive, and only some of the well-placed and wealthy merchants could afford that route of transportation. Or you can ship them overland, over the Pampas, and then over the Andes, and then back down into the Pacific, and that was cheaper. So some of these smaller-scale slavers that were just getting into the game with the deregulation of slavery preferred that route. So more and more in the early 1800s, you saw large caravans of slaves heading out of Buenos Aires and across the Pampas. And it's just a remarkable journey when you think about it, because when we think about slavery, we think of the Atlantic Triangle trade. Sure. We think of the Middle Passage, which was horrible and brutal in all sorts of ways, which are high mortality. But this group of West Africans had something of a second Middle Passage. The trip across the Pampas over land took as long as it took to get across the Atlantic. So this was added to the hardship. Not only were they brought in across the Atlantic, they were shipped across the American continent. And then they approached the Andes. The Andes are the second highest mountain range in the world, but what makes them very impressive and imposing is that they're the narrowest. So the Himalayas, for instance, which are the highest mountain range in the world, tend to rise gradually. So in some ways, the highest points of the Himalayas aren't that impressive, as it takes, by the time you get in sight, you're already fairly high up. The Andes is like approaching some great wall, and particularly from the side of the Pampas, which is preternaturally flat. So you could just imagine what the experience was like for these West Africans across the Pampas and as they approach the Andes. Now, what's even more interesting is that many of the West Africans were Muslim. They were from West Africa, where Islam had migrated down centuries early. And as they approached the Andes was also the beginning of Ramadan. These West Africans track their movement across nearly a third of the globe by following the lunar calendar, Ramadan.
And how do we know this about the route and things that were encountered by this particular group of West Africans?
Well, we don't. I mean, there's most of the documentation are sales receipts and legal documents, and there's nothing that captures the experience of themselves of the subjectivity or the agency or what they experienced as human beings. There is one historical fact that they themselves produced, and that is that they staged their uprising on the ship once they were put back on the ship in the Pacific and a week out of port on the holiest day of Ramadan, the night of power. That's the night that Muslims celebrate as and then the holiest day of Ramadan, the holiest day in Islamic calendar. That's the day that Muslims celebrate when the Archangel Gabriel presented the first verses of the Quran to Muhammad. It's celebrated by Muslims the world over. And the fact that they managed to time and stage their revolt on the eve of the night of power is quite remarkable when you think about it. One, it shows that you know, this their ordeal started over a year earlier, and so they managed to track their movements by keeping watch of the moon, the phases of the moon. Islam holds a lunar calendar, and that they were accurate to the day. And that also meant that when they started their ascent up the Andes, was the first day of Ramadan. So not just the holiest day of Ramadan, but all of Ramadan, a month that holds a very special place in the Islamic calendar, was probably their most extreme ordeal. They were driven up not just the highest mountain range, second highest mountain range in the world, the highest in the Americas, but at the highest point of the Andes, in the shadow of the highest mountain in the Americas. And one could just imagine the way the kind of metaphorical meaning of Ramadan, right, approaching the Godhead, kind of collapsed into the literal material experience of ascending into this extreme environment.
Do you have any sense that this particular group of West African slaves was exceptional? Obviously, the tale, which is at the absolute center of your book, Greg Grand and the Empire of Necessity, is a really remarkable story. But you also say that a number of these slaves had been involved in other rebellions as well. Was that atypical? Do you have a sense of that?
Well, historians have documented about 600 slave ship rebellions, revolts, over the course of the 100 years, but that's really just a faction. Those are just the ones that were recorded, because most slave ship rebellions, revolts, were put down and not reported, so there's no documentary evidence. These West Africans, some of them were involved in two other revolts in outside of Montevideo and Buenos Aires, and which I talk about in the book. But those didn't make it into those aren't counted in the 600. So one can, I mean, for just extrapolating from that, one can assume that there were thousands and thousands of revolts. Enslaved Africans did what they could to achieve their freedom and any opportunity they had, particularly during these extreme moments of hardship, which were, you know, of the transport, of being moved from one place to another.
Well, let me ask you then about Herman Melville's novella, Benito Sereno, which was written almost half a century after this rebellion takes place. How did Melville come at the sort of central aspects of this story? What was included from the historical record? What was left out intentionally? And what was the sentiment that drove his storytelling?
Yeah. So Melville writes Benito Sereno in 1855, and it's a very consequential moment in both his own his life and then in the life of the nation. It's a few years after the failure, the commercial and critical failure of Moby Dick. I mean, now we think of Moby Dick as the American novel, but at the time, critics thought it was an indication either of Melville's irrelevance or his insanity, and it didn't sell. And he was greatly disappointed, and it was one of the precipitating factors in his emotional breakdown. And Benito Sereno was a few years after that, and a few years before the coming of the Civil War. So a very fraught moment. Soon after he finished it, Melville broke down physically and emotionally. There's not a lot of information about what it was that motivated Melville to write this story. He was opposed to slavery, but he also was too fearful that the fight against slavery would destroy the American Republic. So he felt that he was at an impasse. He thought that America faced one of two choices: to either fight slavery and slavery, which might destroy the Republic, either through a civil war, a revolution, or a secession, or leave slavery in place and admit that freedom for some required the enslavement of others. And I think there's something about the bleakness of Benito Sereno that captures that impasse. I mean, the best way to think about Benito Sereno is to compare it to Moby Dick. Moby Dick is, obviously it ends in catastrophe, right? The Pequod goes down and there's only one survivor. But as you're reading that story, there's a lot of joyous moments. There's a lot of joyful moments. There's a lot of humor in the book. It's a very wide open book. It takes place in multiple oceans. There's men of all races coming together, and Melville captures some of the beauty of their interaction and the way they synchronize their movements and their laughter. And it's really just this wonderful book. Benito Sereno is almost the exact opposite in both form and tone. It takes place all on board one ship, one day, but even more than that, it really takes place in the mind of Amasa Delano. Melville tells the story all through Amasa Delano's point of view. Readers don't know the West Africans are in charge until Melville reveals them to be in charge about two-thirds into the story. It's this wonderful, wonderful experiment in capturing the mental processes of the master class. Not the master class, not the slave-owning master class, but this kind of New England, forward-looking, modern man who believed himself on the, you know, to be part of this new world of borning, this world that, you know, this new republican world of freedom and light that New Englanders thought they represented. And Melville, you know, really captures the blindness of that by exploring the thought processes of Amasa Delano, and it's incredibly claustrophobic. Story, and it's an incredibly bleak story in which it just ends in complete and absolute disaster. And I think it indexes his own emotional state and his own political pessimism.
Well, in fact, you write in The Empire of Necessity that for Melville, Ahab and Delano both represent two sides of U.S. expansionism. What do you mean by that?
Well, this goes back to the question that you asked earlier about how Amasa Delano, the real Amasa Delano, could justify his actions in putting down the slave rebellion and then trying to get half the value of the surviving slaves. You know, Ahab is often held up as an icon, as a symbol of unhinged American power. And this is a long tradition. It goes back a while. Oliver Stone in Platoon has this great line where one of the homicidal sergeants who massacres a Vietnamese village, you know, some other character says he's our Ahab. Edward Said famously called George Bush Ahab, you know, equated George Bush's quixotic and obsessive hunt for Saddam Hussein as, you know, Ahab, Melvillian, and its Ahab obsessions, monomania. But, you know, Ahab in many ways is not a good symbol of American power because he's a rebel. His pursuit of the white whale is against all economic interests. It's, you know, there's a famous scene in Moby Dick where Starbuck reminds Ahab that, well, maybe we shouldn't be hunting this white whale because it's going to hurt the profit margins of the owners of the Pequot, you know, back in Nantucket. And Ahab says, owners, what cares Ahab? Let them stand on a Nantucket beach and howl into the wind. You know, it's just, he's a rebel against convention. He's a rebel. I mean, he's obviously destructive to the people around him, but he's not, I think, indicative of the real kind of motive force of American expansion. What's more compelling, I think, about Amasa Delano, both the fictional Amasa Delano as Melville represents him, and the historical one, is that he's not a rebel. He represents a much more complex and in some ways more fraught aspect of American power, the need to maintain labor discipline in a moment of ecological scarcity, in this kind of, you know, during this moment of boom and bust resource extraction capitalism, and he's a much more kind of commonplace symbol of U.S. power, the resource extractor, and the violence that he unleashes in putting down the rebellion is much more driven by the laws of supply and demand, by the need to maintain labor discipline and labor hierarchy during this moment in which ecological scarcity is undermining the ability to maintain that hierarchy and discipline. I think it's a much more damning portrait. I think Amasa Delano is a more typical face of U.S. power than the rebel Ahab.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm joined by historian Greg Grandin. He is here to talk about his book, The Empire of Necessity, Slavery, Freedom, and Deception in the New World. That's published by Metropolitan Books. He's also the author of Fordlandia and Empire's Workshop. So, and we have been discussing this remarkable story of slavery and rebellion which raises all sorts of questions about the meaning of liberty. And I guess I'd like to ask you about the contradiction at the heart of this book, which is that the time in which this story takes place is in many ways the much vaunted age of liberty, right? The American Revolution, the French Revolution, the Haitian Revolution, and yet at the same time it's the age of slavery. And in many ways, in sort of commonplace histories, those things are seen as at odds. If they exist at the same time, it's out of contradictory impulses, or perhaps one is a remnant of the past, the other is the historical progress taking over, and at some point, hopefully, one vanquishes the other. You're making an argument that these things are actually deeply embedded within each other. Rather than being polar opposites, freedom, unfreedom here are tightly bound up together. How is that? And perhaps you could tell us what you mean by freedom, liberty, and unfreedom.
Well, as you mentioned, the story does take place during the Age of Revolution. And 1804, 1805 is the year that Haiti declares its independence. So it's pegged right towards the Haitian Revolution, which is in some ways takes place in the center of the Age of Liberty, a generation after the American Revolution, a generation before the Spanish-American Revolution. When we think of, there's all sorts of ways in which slavery creates the condition for liberty, and just material, in terms of material wealth, and the distribution and generation of prosperity, which allows more and more people to cultivate the higher notion of autonomy and independence and one of individual preference. There was an historian, Edmund Morgan, in the 1970s, who wrote this wonderful book called American Freedom and American Slavery, in which he looked at colonial Virginia and he made the argument, he used the phrase, the paradox of slavery and freedom. And what he meant by that is the ways in which freedom didn't just exist at the same time as slavery, but depended on the expansion of slavery, depended on the wealth of slavery, depended on the prosperity generated by slavery in very real ways, in the sense that the colonists used profits that were generated by slavery to buy the guns in which they could fight European powers. What I tried to do in this book is step back and think about that paradox on a hemisphere-wide scale. I mentioned earlier that the Spaniards, starting in the 1770s, begin to deregulate the slave trade, and a lot of that was in response to the revolutionary period. The Spanish crown wanted to maintain the loyalty of Spanish merchants. So, with the American Revolution, with the French Revolution, with the Haitian Revolution, they began this process of deregulation and expanding slavery. That in turn kicks off this market revolution, this Atlantic market revolution, which is the foundation in many ways of the modern world. It seems a little bit abstract to say that the age of slavery and the age of freedom were one and the same thing, but just think of these numbers and statistics. So historians estimate that there were about 12.5 million Africans taken out of the continent and brought to the Americas in chains. Of that 12.5 million, they have documentary evidence of about 10 million, a little bit over 10 million, ship manifests and whatnot, information on embarkation and disembarkation and so on. Of that 10 million, which took place from the 1500s up until when Brazil ended slavery, the last country in the Americas to end slavery in the 1880s, more than 5 million came after July 4th, 1776. So in very real ways, those statistics show that the way the age of liberty was also the age of slavery.
Of course, freedom can be understood in different ways, but one of them can be around freedom to trade through the market. So when the global market was created in the period following these revolutions, how central did slavery remain to these developing capitalist economies in Europe and in North America?
Well, I think it was absolutely central to the development of capitalism, and this is an insight that historians have known, you know, for decades. But it's something, it's knowledge that seems to be lost with every generation. In 1944, Eric Williams wrote this wonderful book, Capitalism and Slavery, that looked at the way that the slave trade, the Caribbean slave trade, generated the wealth, and you know, secondary industries like shipbuilding generated the wealth that fueled industrialization in England. More recently, there's been historians like Walter Johnson at Harvard and Sven Beckett and others that have looked at the ways in which slavery contributed to the industrialization and financialization of the North. Didn't just create, you know, didn't just generate the capital that funded industrialization in the North, but created financial wealth. You know, many banks and insurance companies from the North got their start underwriting slave enterprises or writing policies on slave lives or slave ships. There's ways in which in Spanish America slavery was absolutely central to what we think of as the market revolution, creating the wealth, tying hinterlands together, you know, the transport of slaves from one region to another, opened up new markets and created new circuits of capital and credit. In Spanish America in particular, slaves were much more diverse. You know, we think of, when we think of slavery in the United States, we tend to think of the explosion of slavery that happens after the 1810s and 1820s with the invention of the cotton gin and the increasing demand for cotton and sugar and the push into the Mississippi and into eastern Texas and opening up of Louisiana and things like that. But in Spanish America, slavery and in North America very much associated with large plantations and plantation export economies, whether it be cotton or sugar. In Spanish America and in Brazil, slaves were much more much more diversified into every aspect of the economy. In Buenos Aires and Montevideo, the typical slave enterprise tended to be one or two or three or four people working in workshops, not in large plantations, bakers and artisans and bricklayers, part of the new urban service economy. They operated more on a spectrum. Many slaves were actually paid wages in Spanish America, so they were also consumers. Slaves, and you know, they were capital, they were credit, slavers could rent out their slaves to others, and which slaves earned a wage, and they had to kick up part of their wage to their owners. It was a much more diversified labor system in Spanish America. I mean, there were plantations, there were sugar plantations, and large scale mining operations, but it was much more kind of integrated into everyday economics. And it was much more, as you know, slavery was an economic system, but it was also a psychic and emotional one as well. And slaves were status symbols. They were, for a rising gentry and merchant class, the number of slaves you own was a symbol of your success. You know, merchant women couldn't go to mass on Sunday without trailing a long procession of slave servants, well-dressed slave servants behind them to tend to them. For a declining aristocracy, the liberalization of the slave trade was part of the liberalization of the larger market that was eroding their position and allowing, more and more new wealth to rise up.
Sure, you actually have a interesting story about the rather reactionary Argentine writer Jorge Luis Borges
and
his citing his grandmother's involvement in buying slaves.
I mean, I use that as a way to talk a little bit about this, the emotional attachment that many could have towards slavery and the nostalgia. So, for a declining aristocracy, they might see slaves as the last kind of solid object, and they latched onto them like cattle and livestock. And the slaver that was actually responsible for bringing these West Africans into the Pacific was from a provincial town, Mendoza, and he was part of a declining aristocracy that got into the slave trade as a way of kind of shoring up his position in this fast-changing economy. But he couldn't afford to bring them by ship around Cape Horn, so he transported them himself across the Pampas and over the Andes, and he was killed in the uprising.
Well, that diversity of form that you're just describing, that slavery didn't just follow the template that we may picture of slavery in the U.S. South, that you would find these sort of hybrid forms, such as slaves who actually were wage earners and still enslaved. Then brings me to the question about other forms of sort of bonded work that wasn't officially slavery. What else was happening for those people who were not caught up in slavery but still were part of the labor force? To what degree did you find forms of labor that were coerced or bonded in some way?
Yeah, so the book in some ways is an ethnography of the experience of freedom and slavery, right? And even though in the United States those two ideals, freedom and slavery, were increasingly defined as antagonistic and opposite, right? Freedom was understood to be the opposite of slavery. The reality was that most people, if not all people, lived somewhere in between those two poles. And in the book, where I look at that the most was the experience of sealers, the sealing crew, you know, the sealers that were left on these islands, that were left to seal, the debts that they incurred, the ways that they tried to fight the debt and break out of the debt, the ways that they were bonded on these ships. One of the things that's interesting is that the ship itself, the Trial, the Spanish slave ship, was actually seized by Spaniards from this Quaker sealer / smuggler, and on board that ship was an array of different forms of labor, including indentures and African American and American Indian children who was sold into indentureship and served as cabin boys and whatnot on ships. So there's this way. So what I try to do in the book is show the lived experience of what it was like to live between these two extreme poles of freedom and slavery.
My name is Sasha Lilly. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm speaking with Greg Grandin, historian. He teaches at NYU, and he is the author of The Empire of Necessity, which we're discussing today. So how central, then, when you talk about the ubiquity of some kind of coercive labor in these societies across the board, how did race play such a central role, though? Because, of course, you know, there would be white people who would find themselves as indentured servants. But clearly, there's also something that was very particular about generating notions of difference and inferiority. How did that play out in a society where unfreedom didn't just follow simple racial lines?
Well, I think it hardens. I think that's one of the things that is so compelling about Amasa Delano, both the real one and Melville's rendition, is that I think he signals to a new kind of racism, right? A new kind of racism that's born in chattel slavery, but outlives chattel slavery. It's a racism that isn't justified in terms of theology or justified in terms of philosophy, but more on the psychic need to define one's freedom in relationship to another's absolute slavishness. And that's what's so compelling, ultimately, I think, about to come back to the deception and what it is that's so shocking and why Amasa Delano is not able to see what's in front of his eyes, is that these West Africans, they were exposing, I think, the fundamental deceit on which slavery as an institution was founded on, the idea that slaves had no independent interior lives, that they had no discipline, that they had no resources, that they had no cunning, that they couldn't use that cunning to manipulate reality. And here was a group of West Africans that were doing exactly that. They were using the things they were said not to have, not to possess, reason and cunning and discipline, in order to give the lie to the things that they were said to be humble and simple-minded and loyal and faithful. And I think that this set piece that opens up the book captures that tension. And Amasa Delano, who understands himself as free in all senses of the word, he believes himself to be a man who possesses reason, a man who can use his reason and his will and his resources in order to control his appetites and his passions and his emotions. And he's confronted with a group of people which he measures that that ability against, you know, because he measures his freedom against the West Africans' slavishness, and they reveal that to not be the case, that he was the one that was actually trapped and enslaved by his own prejudices, his own biases, and his own emotions, his own weird yearnings that he had about Benito Cereño and Maury the slave. And it's the West Africans who were actually able to summon up the remarkable willpower in under conditions of enormous hardship in order to play their role. And I think that deception really gets at the heart of the fundamental deception that is slavery, but then also the way that deception metastasizes throughout society as market relations, as capitalist relations spread, and as there is more of a kind of a gap and wedge driven between substance and appearance that capitalism drives forward. And what I try to do in the book is look at the centrality of race to that, the way slavery was implicated in all sorts of complicated ways, and why race outlives slavery, right? Why this kind of, you know, this new racism that Amasa Delano, I think, captures and embodies outlives it, and the ways in which this, you know, particularly in the United States, what is a cult of individual supremacy and is manifest in all sorts of policies and politics and political reactions in the United States really has its roots in white supremacy, and why, you know, the contemporary politics can't escape the language of race and the rhetoric of race and the symbology of race and the Civil War. You know, I don't know whether, you know, the Tea Party and the radical right are racist in a simple way. You know, some of them are and some of them aren't, I'm sure. But the language in which that they use to understand contemporary politics is deeply rooted in the history of racism and slavery during this moment.
One of the things that you point to about the way that these questions of freedom and freedom how, I guess, is part of it, and the centrality of the market in defining what's free, is the way that society has shifted since that time, and that some things have become less visible that might have been out in the open before. You write about sort of invisible traps. So I wonder if you could speak about that, the way that clearly people are still bound up in very complex exploitative relations through the market, but there's nothing as overt as slavery. Very few people, I mean, one can find some exceptions, but really very few people find themselves in any kind of formal position of slavery in this society. So what was lost in having what was so very horrifically visible evolve and change or disappear, but other things taking its place?
Yeah, well, this is an argument that David Brian Davis, the great historian of slavery, makes, is that slavery had the benefit of condensing an extremely brutal form, these relations of exploitation that have existed and still exist in different ways. And the fight against slavery was a process of reification and abstraction, in which slavery itself was seen as the only and an isolated evil, and you do away with that formally, and then it tends to obscure the way that slavery continues in other forms. And I'm not just talking about, you know, wage slavery. I'm talking about the way that slaves, you know, emancipated Africans were re-enslaved through debt bondage and peonage and slavery by other dames and, you know, things like that. But also the ways in which, on a more generalized, it contributes to this cult of individualism. And this, I think, is ultimately what Herman Melville gets at, that he was a very strong critic of the extreme individualism that was taking hold. You know, I think he believed that people existed somewhere between the two poles of freedom and slavery that were structuring the political rhetoric of antebellum America. And you know, he has a lot throughout his writings. He talks about how we're all born in whale lines. We all come into the world with halters on our neck. We're all fast fish. We're all loose fish. Meaning that we're nobody's completely free. Who ain't a slave? I think he had a um, he he believe that this rhetoric of absolute freedom blinded people to the dependency that they had on one another, and it's a kind of moral standpoint that I take in the book and use as the book's ending.
Rick Randon, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much, Sasha.
I've been speaking with the author of The Empire of Necessity, Slavery, Freedom, and Deception in the New World. That's published by Metropolitan Books. Greg Randon is also the author of Fordlandia and Empire's Workshop, and he teaches history at NYU. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.
And welcome back. This is Abayomi Ezekwe. We just listened to an audio documentary on the 1805 slave rebellion in the Pacific off the coast of South America involving West Africans who had taken over a slave ship. And of course, it was pointed out in that documentary that there were at least 600 documented slave ship rebellions during the period of the Atlantic slave trade. Yet it was also acknowledged that many of these revolts were not documented, and of course there may have been thousands of such rebellions during the course of the Atlantic slave trade. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. Today is Sunday, September 7th, 2014. We're broadcasting live from our studios here in downtown Detroit. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in to the Pan-African Journal for this week, and we'll be right back with more of the Pan-African Journal.
Well, that's two trains running. Well, ain't now one hole going my way. Well, now one running at midnight, the other one running just for days. They're running just for days. Running just for day. Oh Lord, short of the hill. Oh well, ho ho. I do hate to lose. I do hate to lose. Oh Lord, sure enough I do. Oh well. Oh well.
body so long and tall. Tennessee, we lie, oh, I will see. Well, Lottie says she's no good, but she's all right. She's all right with me. She's all right, she's all right. She's all right, she's all right.
Welcome back. You're listening to Abayomi Ezekwe, the host of the Pan-African Journal. And if you want to have access to this program as well as other archived editions of the Pan-African Journal, all you have to do is log on to the Pan-African Radio Network, and that website is blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. And by logging on to that website, you can have access not only to this program, but other programs from the archives of the Pan-African Journal. This is Abayomi Ezekwe. We'll be right back with more of this week's program.
Perils of Empire. When the U.S. launched its invasion of Iraq, predicated on the events of 9/11, it was the very quintessence of hubris. Neoconservatives dreamed of remaking the Middle East in their own image. It was, in truth, a mad dream, a nightmare born of the drug of soul superpower. It's been a decade since, and none of their dreams have come true. Indeed, it's quite the reverse. The Middle East is a tinderbox enclosed in a powder keg. It is more unstable today than it has ever been, perhaps since decolonization. Its people are frustrated, paralyzed by powerful princes and predatory militaries, armies armed against their own people. The fruits of empire are foul indeed, and the worst is yet to come. We are seeing some of it in today's Iraq, but assuredly, there is more, much more, to come. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Tomcat fight all night. Why do all of these men try to run a big lay woman down? Why do all of these men try to run a big lay woman down? The same old thing that makes a bulldog hug a hound. Oh, that same thing. Oh, that same thing. Tell me who's to blame. The whole world fighting about that same. Same old thing that
boys made a preacher lay his Bible down. Oh, that same.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal. I am your host, Abayomi Azikwe. We just heard the music of McKinley Morganfield, better known as Muddy Waters, and the tune entitled Same Thing. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikwe. Today is Sunday, September the 7th, 2014. We're broadcasting live from our studios here in downtown Detroit. Right now, we're going to go to our vaults of the Pan-African Journal and present to you the Pan-African Journal New York City version that aired earlier on January the 6th of this year. The program is hosted by yours truly, Abayomi Azikwe, and produced by Bernard White of Community Progressive Radio in New York City. This program, as we mentioned earlier, was recorded on January the 6th, 2014. And we will be coming up with the New York City version of the Pan-African Journal, hosted by Abayomi Azikwe, produced by Bernard White. Let's listen in. Greetings once again. This is Abayomi Azikwe. Welcome back to this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikwe. And in today's Pan-African Journal, we'll be dealing with some of the following stories. The widow of John Garang, the founder of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement, Rebecca Nyadong, has blamed South Sudan President Salva Kiir for the outbreak of violence and unrest. Greetings once again. This is Abayomi Azikwe. Welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis, and I am your host, Abayomi Azikwe. In this first program for 2014, we'll be dealing with the following stories. The neo-colonial regime in the North African state of Libya is saying that it is resuming production of oil despite a continuing blockade of drilling and distribution centers. Meanwhile, the bodies of a New Zealander and a Briton have been discovered inside the country, which has experienced chaos and underdevelopment since the imperialist war, a regime change nearly 3 years ago. A new survey has revealed that the most people around the world views the United States as the major threat to international peace. The Pentagon and the CIA is engaging in massive bombing and destabilization efforts across the planet. A South Sudanese general has been killed in an ambush outside the capital of Jonglei at Bor. Meanwhile, negotiations are underway in Ethiopia between President Salva Kiir and ousted Vice President Riek Machar. Fighting has intensified inside the country over the last several days. And also in this week's program, we'll be doing an update on developments surrounding the imposed bankruptcy in the city of Detroit. And this is Abayomi Azikwe. We, of course, want to thank all of our listeners for tuning in. And our first story will deal with developments inside the North African state of Libya. Libya says that it is starting to drill oil and distribute oil again in its southern oil fields amid an ongoing blockade. Libya says that it has restarted oil production at the El Sharara field in the south of the country after protesters ended a blockade. Now, this is according to reports from the international media. The National Oil Corporation said that it was shipping the equivalent of 60,000 barrels of oil per day. It hopes to reach the field's maximum output capacity of around 340,000 barrels per day within 3 days' time. Blockades of oil terminals since July have severely restricted exports of oil, Libya's main source of income. It comes as the neocolonial government tries to assert itself over up to its 1,700 different armed militias and rebel groups, each with its own goals and command structures, following the Central Intelligence Agency, Pentagon, and NATO war regime change and counter-revolution that toppled and brutally murdered Muammar Gaddafi during 2011. Now, since the blockades of ports have begun during 2013, all exports have fallen from more than 1 million barrels per day to just over 110,000 barrels per day, according to international trade publications. Libya makes almost all its revenue on an annual basis of around $50 billion from the sale of oil. Workers in the oil sector are entitled to a 67% rise in their salaries from January, a government measure intended to shore up the industry and to hold on to staff, as well as to put an end to industrial action. British oil worker Mark Salas and his New Zealand partner Len Howie were killed this week in an area that is home to a large oil and gas complex co-owned by the Italian energy giant Eni. Now, in specific reference to the two foreigners who was found dead in the North African state of Libya, the Brit that was shot dead in Libya has been named as Mark DeSalis. He is an energy engineer who worked in Tripoli, the capital, for 6 years. He had worked there even prior to the U.S. and NATO bombing of 2011, as well as the counter-revolution of 2011. DeSalis was gunned down alongside a female friend from New Zealand near the coastal town of Melata, where their bodies were left lying face down in the sand. Mr. DeSalis' family said they were, quote, shocked and devastated, end quote, by discovery of Thursday of his body. The pair were thought to have been having a picnic when they were ambushed and shot in the head. Mr. DeSalis, who was 48 years old, who worked for First Engineering, was employed as a power manager bringing electrical generators to the Libyan capital of Tripoli. The family said that he, quote, liked the Libyan people, unquote, and remembered him as a, quote, decent and incredibly loyal man, and he was loved by many, end quote. They said he had been with a, quote, close friend from New Zealand who was also killed, and our thoughts are with family at this sad time, unquote. The woman who was visiting Libya worked for oil giant Blue Energy based in Australia. The woman's family have asked for privacy but confirmed that she resided in New Zealand. Westerners have been warned about the increasingly unstable situation in Libya, where an American teacher was shot dead while jogging just 4 weeks ago. A week ago, four American military personnel were briefly detained not far from the same area of Melata, which is home to a large oil and gas complex co-owned by the Italian company Eni. Nearly 2 years after the overthrow of Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, the North African country has descended into a state of lawlessness as rival militias struggle for power and wealth. The so-called Libyan police forces said that a probe had been launched into the deaths, but that there were still no leads as to who the killers were or their motives. The Foreign Office advises against all travel to most parts of Libya, including Benghazi, and against all but essential travel to coastal areas to the west and east, including the capital of Tripoli. It warns of a, quote, high threat from terrorism, including kidnapping, unquote, in the country. The Foreign Office in Britain, their officials have already urged the Libyan government to hold a, quote, thorough investigation, unquote, into the murders. A spokesman said, quote, "We call upon the Libyan government to carry out a thorough investigation into this tragic incident and to continue to do all it can to bring to justice the perpetrators of this appalling crime as it strives to build strong rule of law in Libya," unquote. And more information on the shooting death of a British citizen as well as a citizen of New Zealand. Authorities, just this last Friday, January 3rd, identified a British man and a woman from New Zealand as the foreigners who were killed. And their bodies were found on a beach just west of the capital of Tripoli. Libya's foreign ministry said they had discovered the bodies. They were shot on Thursday, January the 2nd, in Militao, located west of the city of Sabratha. And this is according to a statement by the official Libyan news agency. The statement said that, quote, "The foreign ministry is following up with great interest on the progress of the investigation into the killings," unquote. The British government confirmed one of them was a Briton. A New Zealand's foreign ministry said the other was one of its citizens. Neither were identified, and there were no further information about how or when they died. Quote, "The exact circumstances of their deaths is not yet clear and will be subject to an investigation by the so-called Libyan authorities," said the New Zealand ministry in a statement, adding that its slain national was visiting Libya. The Sabratha local council, the area governing body, also acknowledged the killings in a statement. The statement said, "The Sabratha local council and the residents of the area offer their deepest condolences to the families of the deceased and to the states of Britain and New Zealand, as this act is contrary to our morals and values of our religion," end quote. The two foreigners have been reported missing, and police were searching for them when their bodies were discovered, the Sabratha Media Center, a local activist news group, said in a statement. It was not immediately clear from the media center how long they had been missing or when exactly they died. Their bodies were found on Talil Sahib Beach, about 50 miles or approximately 85 kilometers west of Tripoli, added the media group, which noted that they had been killed. An initial police investigation showed the two had been picnic in a somewhat remote area near a partially built resort. A photo posted on Sabratha Media Center Facebook page purports to show the man and woman who were lying face down in the sand. Near the bodies is a blanket that is spread out with food and drinks thrown about. A backpack is also nearby. Now, of course, most media outlets were not able to admit the authenticity of the photo, which is the Sabratha Media Center said it obtained and posted on Facebook. The police investigation indicated tire marks in the area. There has been a rise in crime in the area in recent weeks, including a Libyan man who was killed in a reported carjacking, according to the local Sabratha Media Center. The beaches in and around Sabratha are among some of the most developed on Libya's western coastline. They were a popular destination for picnics and swimming among foreigners before the 2011 uprising that ousted leader Muammar Gaddafi. And, of course, those are some developments that have been taking place in the North African state of Libya. Coming up on February the 17th, it will represent the third anniversary of the beginning of the Libyan counter-revolution. Events in Benghazi in the eastern region of the country led to a huge conflagration inside the country. Some 1 month later, after the Libyan government under Muammar Gaddafi sought to put down the uprising in the east, as well as it spreading to other parts of the country, the United Nations Security Council passed 2 resolutions. These resolutions were designed to provide a legal rationale for the massive and blanket bombing of North African state of Libya. Beginning on March 19th, the U.S. as well as the Pentagon and its allies in the Middle East began a massive ordnance campaign against the Gaddafi government and the Libyan people. This campaign lasted for some 7 months, resulting in the deaths of some 50 100,000 people, also in the dislocation of some 2 million Libyans. Hundreds of thousands of foreign nationals, as well as Libyan nationals, who have been employed in the oil and natural gas industry, in the construction industry, the healthcare industry, and other service industries inside of Libya, lost their jobs. Many of them were forced to flee the country. Since the counter-revolution in Libya in 2011, the country has sunk into a myriad of social and security problems. As we just mentioned earlier, foreign nationals are being killed on a regular basis. The economy is still heavily destabilized. The production and distribution of oil has dropped at least some 90% since the advent of neocolonialism in Libya. Of course, the instability inside of Libya has spread to other neighboring countries in North as well as West Africa. In the current conflict that is going on in the West African state of Mali has a direct relationship to the massive bombing of Libya during 2011. And of course, the unrest in the northern part of Mali, where Tuareg separatists as well as Islamist guerrillas have been clashing against the central government in the south of Mali based in the capital of Bamako, and also brought about the intervention of France as well as Chadian and other troops from various parts of the African continent. Nonetheless, the situation in the north of Mali is still not stable. The conflict in the north of Mali spread 1 year ago into southern Algeria, where the En Amenas gas fields were attacked, resulting in a crackdown by the Algerian military and security forces, resulting in the deaths of at least 70 people in the retaking of the En Amenas gas fields. Consequently, the role of the United States and NATO, of course, has spread not stability, not economic prosperity, but instability and economic decline throughout Libya as well as other contiguous states in both North as well as West Africa. And right now, we're going to take a brief break, and we'll be right back with more of this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal.
Talking about war and rumors of war. Talking about the coming of Jah. The time is not far. Oh my majesty, please rescue me. Oh my majesty, can you?
According to a news article published by RT.com, Worldwide Satellite Television News Service, the United States has been voted as the most significant threat to world peace, and this is according to a survey conducted in some 68 different countries. Anti-American sentiment was not only recorded in antagonistic countries, but also in many allied NATO partners like Turkey as well as Greece. A global survey conducted by the Worldwide Independent Network and the Gallup at the end of 2013 revealed strong animosity towards the United States' role as the world's policeman. Citizens across over 60 nations were asked, quote, which country do you think is the greatest threat to peace in the world today, unquote. The U.S. topped the list with 24% of people believing America to be the biggest danger to peace. Pakistan came second with 8% of the vote and was closely followed by China with 6%. Afghanistan, Iran, Israel, and North Korea came in joint fourth place with 5% of the vote. The threat from the U.S. Was rated most highly in the Middle East and North Africa, those areas most recently affected by the American military interventions. Moreover, the survey showed that even Americans regard their own country as a potential threat, with 13% of them voting the United States could disrupt the global status quo. Latin America expressed mixed feelings towards its northerly neighbor, with Peru, Brazil, and Argentina all flagging the United States as the most dangerous country in the world. After its numerous threats of a strike on Iran, many countries voted Israel was the biggest threat to prosperity. Morocco, Lebanon, and Iraq all choose Israel as the number one danger to world peace.
And the survey participants were also asked if there were no barriers in living in any country of the world, which country would you like to live in? Despite being the perceived largest threat to world peace, the United States still topped the tables by a narrow margin of 9%. In general, 2013 saw a drop in approval ratings for the Obama administration as well. A poll conducted by the APNORC Center for Public Affairs Research revealed that 50% of those asked thought that the political system in the United States needed a, quote, complete overhaul, unquote. In addition, 70% of Americans believe the government lacks the ability to make progress on the important problems and issues facing the country in 2014, unquote. The survey comes 2 months after the first government shutdown in 17 years in the United States, which cost the country an estimated $10 billion. The American government's credibility was dealt a blow earlier this year when President Obama made a call to strike Syria following a suspected chemical weapons attack by the Syrian government on civilians. The American public and the international community both opposed the action that had been slated to take place against the Middle Eastern nation of Syria. And of course, this survey is quite revealing. It indicates that the perception that the U.S. tries to project around the world is definitely not shared by the majority of the people who live in the world. Of course, this lack of confidence, of course, this lack of the will as perceived by those who view the United States is, of course, a very, very important development. And this survey has gotten broad international attention. It was published by Russia Today over its international worldwide satellite television website. A good indication of the role of the United States in regard to fostering destabilization throughout the world is reflective of the current political, social, and security situation in the Middle Eastern nation of Iraq, a nation that was occupied for some 8.5 years by the United States Pentagon and the Central Intelligence Agency. Prior to the 2003 invasion and occupation of Iraq, the country had been devastated and heavily destroyed as a result of the imposition of the United Nations sanctions against that country beginning in 1990 and 1991. And of course, these sanctions were imposed largely at the aegis of the United States. With specific reference to the political toll that has been suffered by the people of Iraq, a toll of 8,868 people, including 7,818 civilians, were killed in violent attacks across Iraq last year in 2013. This is according to a United Nations report, the highest annual death toll in the war-torn country in 5 years. In December alone, that is December 2013, at least 759 Iraqis were killed and another 1,345 were wounded in terrorist attacks and violence. This is according to a report from the United Nations Assistance Mission for Iraq, which monitors the impact of armed violence and terrorism on Iraqi civilians. May was the most violent month of 2013. According to the mission statistics, was a total of 3,154 civilian casualties, including civilian police, of whom 963 people killed and 2,191 wounded. Since April of 2013, the monthly number of civilians killed and injured remained above 1,700. According to UNIROC, Baghdad was the most affected area in Iraq last year for civilian casualties, with 809, including 254 killed, followed by Nineveh with 331 casualties, and Salahuddin with 262 casualties, and Diyala 260 casualties. Quote, this is a sad and terrible record, which confirms once again the urgent need for the Iraqi authorities to address the roots of violence to curb this internal strife, unquote, said the special representative of the United Nations Secretary General for Iraq, Nikolai Mladenov. However, there's no mention of the outright destruction and destabilization that the United States brought on the nation of Iraq one of the most prosperous and stable governments and societies within the entire Middle East prior to the First Gulf War of 1991. Of course, these problems within Iraq are being blamed on the Iraq themselves in order not to reveal once again the illegal and unjust character of the U.S. sanctions against Iraq beginning in 1990 and 91, continuing these destabilization efforts continuing inside Iraq. Well, consequently, these reports have to be looked at within this specific regard. Now, of course, he condemned Mr. Mladenov. He condemned, quote, the level of indiscriminate violence in Iraq, unquote, and called on Iraqi leaders to take the necessary steps to prevent terrorist groups to fuel the sectarian tensions would contribute to the weakening of the social fabric of society. The mission chief also recently expressed his concerns about the situation in Anbar province, where Islamist militants stormed police stations on Wednesday, seizing weapons, caches, and freeing 100 prisoners. The attacks were caused by deeply rooted sectarian tensions between Iraqi Sunni groups and Shia-led governments of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. Maliki ordered reinforcements in the province, but expressed the government's readiness to listen to Anbar residents to address their needs in his weekly televised speech. He also called on all Sunni tribes to, quote, come together, unquote, and to team up with the security forces to fight the militants, quote, for the sake of Anbar, unquote. Iraq is not the only organization that counts casualties in the country. The Iraq Body Count, the IBC project, a web-based effort to record civilian deaths in Iraq, has recently released its own report. According to IBC, nearly 9,500 civilians died in violence in Iraq in 2013. Quote, Al-Qaeda in Iraq has found fertile ground and has attacked the Iraqi government by killing members of its army, its police force, its politicians and journalists, as well as the Shia population. Indeed, the last 6 months have been the massacres of entire families, and they sleep as they sleep, travel to a holy place, sometimes 5, sometimes 12 family members at a time. The faults are now as wide as the deep as trenches, unquote, the IBC reports. Dubbed by RT, quote, the year of carnage, unquote, Iraq indeed saw its deadliest time since 2008. After the bloodiest period of 2006 and 2007, the tensions seemed to ease a little as a result of the U.S. military so-called surge strategy. However, after U.S. Troops left in 2011, Iraqis left to come to terms with nearly a decade of a brutal imperialist war. It soon became clear that the deep inner ethnic fissures that almost tore the country apart were merely bandaged, but not remedied. Hardly a day goes by in Iraq without dozens killed or injured in numerous blasts outside schools, mosques, or crowded markets, as the terrorists and the sectarian gangs kill indiscriminately, including women and children, the disabled, and even pilgrims to worship their religion. And a report on the current security situation outside of Iraq confirms the belief on the part of many people throughout the world that the United States, its policies, and its efforts throughout the world are the greatest danger to international peace. We'll be right back with more of this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal. Welcome back. This is Abayomi Azifa. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal. This is our first program for 2014. Throughout the press, both inside the United States and internationally, there's been much discussion, news and news analysis on the current situation in the Republic of South Sudan. On Sunday, January 5th, two warring factions from South Sudan held direct peace talks for the first time since the conflict began. And, of course, this has been going on now since December the 15th. The conflict itself has sent hundreds of thousands of people fleeing for safety. The direct talks focus on the development of a ceasefire and the release of political prisoners in order to put representatives of Salva Kiir and former Vice President Riek Machar together in Ethiopia. There has to be some preliminary agreements. South Sudan has experienced 3 weeks of violence. Kiir says the violence began as a coup attempt on December 15th, though Machar, his side, denies the allegations of attempting a coup. Violence began as a political dispute, but has since taken on ethnic dimensions, with the Nuer and the Dinka nationalities attacking each other based upon political loyalties to the president, Salva Kiir, and the ousted vice president, Riek Machar. The United Nations has said at least 1,000 people have died in the fighting since December the 15th. Some 200,000 people have been displaced by the fighting. Rebel forces loyal to Machar now control two of the state most lucrative capitals, including the town of Bor, about 120 kilometers, that is about 70 miles north of the capital, Juba. Gunfire was heard in Juba on the evening of Saturday, January the 4th. South Sudan Information Minister Michael Louith said this on January the 5th, that forces loyal to Machar instigated the violence, but that it was soon brought under control. Embassies, aid groups, and the United Nations have sent personnel out of the country in the fear that the fighting engulfed the capital as it did in the first couple of days of violence. The U.S. Embassy, just this last past Friday, January the 3rd, sent more personnel out of the country. United States Secretary of State John Kerry said on January the 5th, the beginning of direct talks was an important step, but that both sides need to put the interests of South Sudan above their own. The United States played a big role in bringing decades of war in the region to an end by fostering the partition of the Republic of South Sudan from the Republic of Sudan in the north. Of course, the civil war, which lasted for some 20 years, resulted in the deaths of many Sudanese on both sides in the north as well as the south. Quote, according to John Kerry, I think all of us feel a very personal stake in trying to avert tribal warfare and ethnic confrontation on the ground as well as any kind of resolution of political differences by force, unquote. Kerry, of course, in making such a statement, avoids the U.S. culpability for fostering the breakaway Republic of South Sudan without providing any fundamental infrastructural development programs that will prepare the Republic of South Sudan to become a viable nation state in the 21st century. Kerry said that the United States will not support anyone who uses force to seize power, although they did support the SPLA, the Sudan People's Liberation Army, which is the military wing of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement, the ruling party in the Republic of South Sudan, and this carried out for many, many years. Of course, he was directing his comments to the ousted Vice President Riek Machar. The U.S. has also called on President Kiir's government to release political prisoners aligned with Machar so they can take part in the peace talks. South Sudan Information Minister Louith said on January the 5th, he chafed at that suggestion, saying to release the political prisoners sets a bad precedent. Quote, we're not saying we don't release them, but it will be done according to our laws, unquote, he said. Louith also threatened to detain the widow of the man regarded as the father of the country, the late John Garang. Louith said the widow, Rebecca Nandan D. Mabor, is spreading, quote, negative propaganda, unquote. John Garang died in a mysterious helicopter crash in Uganda in 2005, 2 years after a comprehensive peace agreement was signed between the Khartoum government in the Republic of Sudan and the then autonomous South Sudan, headed by John Garang, the founder of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement and the Sudan People's Liberation Army. His widow, Rebecca Nadang D. Mabior, has been a critic of the current president, Salva Kiir, who is now facing his most significant challenge from the ousted president, Riek Machar. Also, in the Republic of South Sudan, the fighting is continuing as warring parties met in Ethiopia on Sunday, January the 5th, to try to agree on ceasefire. Substantive talks were scheduled to start on that day, January the 5th, and of course, in adding to the existing tensions inside the country, a South Sudanese army general has been killed in fighting outside the rebel-held town of Bor. This overall conflict is pitting supporters of President Salva Kiir against the other faction led by the former deputy president, Riek Machar. Began on December the 15th after the president accused Machar of attempting a coup d'etat, which Machar has denied. At least 1,000 people have been killed and nearly 200,000 displaced in the conflict, which has taken on ethnic undertones. Mr. Kiir is from the Dinka nationality and Mr. Machar from the Nuer group. The BBC's Alistair Lighthead, who is with government troops some 25 kilometers, approximately 15 miles from Bor, the capital of Jonglé State, says large numbers of reinforcements have been brought in, bringing the total there to some 2,000 troops. President Kiir's forces have been trying for several days to retake Bor, according to the BBC correspondent. The fighting, in effect, involves two trained armies, as the rebel forces include former armor units, according to international correspondents. Fighting is also continuing in other areas. Army spokesman Philip Aguirre said there had been clashes in the oil-producing states of Unity and Upper Nile in the north. Up until Friday, January the 3rd, the talks in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa, were conducted by mediators. Now, teams representing the imposing factions are expected to negotiate face-to-face. A preliminary meeting was held late Saturday on January the 4th. Key issues are establishing a ceasefire and the rebels' demand for the release of what they see as being political prisoners. These people were high-ranking officials in the government of the Republic of South Sudan. They were arrested under the guise that they were supporters of the ousted president, Riek Machar. The South Sudan spokesman, Michael Mukee, said the government would resist international pressure to free supporters of Mr. Machar, who were arrested in the capital of Juba at the beginning of the conflict around December the 15th. He said releasing, quote, those who attempted to overthrow a democratically elected government, end quote, would set a, quote, bad precedent, unquote. Quote, are we not risking the governments of Africa and the rest of the world to such attempts? We should not be arm-twisted because we are a new nation, end quote. Meanwhile, the first aid flight to South Sudan, funded by the British government, has arrived inside the country. The aircraft carrying emergency aid and sanitation supplies landed in Juba on Sunday, January 5th. South Sudan is the world's newest state. It was formed in 2011, gaining independence from Sudan after decades of conflict and civil war. The latest troubles has its roots in tensions that go back before 2011. And the situation in South Sudan, of course, is getting worse. And, of course, the fighting inside the country has brought in as well regional powers, including the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, IGAD, which is a East African Economic Regional Organization. Delegations from South Sudan's government and rebels were set to begin talks on January the 4th. However, they were postponed to Sunday, January the 5th. And also, East African regional leaders struggle to end nearly a month of intense fighting in the world's youngest nation. On January the 3rd, mediators from the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, IGAD, held separate talks with representatives from two warring parties currently gathered for ceasefire talks in the Ethiopian capital of Addis Ababa. Ethiopia's Ministry of Foreign Affairs confirmed that the negotiations mediated by the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, IGAD, began on January the 3rd. Quote, both delegations are meeting mediators separately, according to Dina Muti, Ethiopia's foreign ministry spokesman, and she said this on January the 3rd. Quote, "We hope to bring both sides into a face-to-face talk soon," unquote. Muti said that Igad is committed to supporting the peace process to bring an end to the weeks of violence in South Sudan that has killed over 1,000 people and displaced hundreds of thousands of others. Friday's discussions were aimed at narrowing existing differences between the two sides to pave way for direct renegotiations, which were scheduled to have begun on Wednesday, January the 1st. Preconditions set by the leaders of the rebels, who are really not rebels, they actually represent a conventional military force that has split away from President Salva Kiir, are believed to be slowing the process. The former vice president has demanded that all political prisoners be released and that a mechanism to monitor all the accused strongly deny this and claim that Kiir took the opportunity of infighting within the armies to bind Dan Guy, whom Kiir sacked from the position in Unity State as Unity State governor last year, is leading the dissident negotiating team after he managed to escape from Juba without being arrested. Muti said that direct talks were likely to begin on Sunday. That was January 5th. Authorities have blocked access to all journalists from the Addis Ababa Sheraton Hotel, the venue for the talks. Ethiopian officials who are playing a leading role in brokering a truce are optimistic that a ceasefire agreement will be reached in the coming days, but others are skeptical as the two sides continue trying to gain a military advantage on the ground. And of course, the two sides in the conflict in the Republic of South Sudan have been issuing contradictory claims and contradictory reports in regard to the fighting that is taking place on the ground. The South Sudanese Army has dismissed reports that supporters of ousted Vice President Riek Machar were moving towards the capital of Juba, saying that they were instead retreating from the capital of Juba. Colonel Philip Aguirre, the spokesperson for the SPLA, told the Sudan Tribune on Friday, January the 3rd, that the so-called rebels, quote, will be running, not advancing, unquote. He said that, quote, there is no threat to Juba, unquote, Aguirre confidently said in a telephone interview. South Sudan has been in a state of crisis since President Salva Kiir accused Machar and other senior members of his ruling Sudan People's Liberation Movement of attempting to oust his government in mid-December last year. Infighting within the army on December the 15th spread to other parts of the capital, while reports that civilians were targeted on the basis of their ethnicity led to parts of the army rebelling in Jonglei State and Unity State, as well as Upper Nile. Aguirre said the SPLA forces were advancing towards Bor, the capital of Jonglei, to flush out of the supporters of ousted Vice President Riek Machar that held the town for several days. The mutineers took control of Bor, the capital of Jonglei, at least 5 days ago, the second time they have wrestled control of the area from the forces loyal to President Salva Kiir since the conflict erupted on December the 15th. The army spokesperson, however, stressed that the rebels, quote, will be running from Bor, not advancing to Juba, unquote. Quote, we have not yet taken complete control of Bor. There is a fighting going on there. It is a matter of time before our forces get complete control, of what he said on Friday, January the 3rd. The army, Aguirre said, were also looking to retake Bentiu, the capital of Unity State, which is home to South Sudan's most productive oil fields. The rebels, which are, in fact, they are labeling as rebels, are supporters of Riek Machar, last week claimed that oil production was halted as key staff were evacuated from the capital of Unity State in Bentiu. He said the SPLA forces were advancing onto Bentiu from both Panring and Mayum counties. Quote, they have already taken control of Mayum and moving towards Bentiu, unquote, explained the military spokesperson. Quote, the only exit strategy for these renegade forces is surrender, unquote, he said, adding that the army may attempt to starve them out. Quote, their sources of food supplies are looting only. These loots will soon dry off as a National Army. We call on our people to stand behind the FPLA forces in defense of the territorial integrity, sovereignty, and constitution, unquote, Aguirre stressed during his statement. The FPLA stands ready to defend the country, its people, their properties, and from protecting them from any physical threat or harm, Aguirre added. But an official connected to the soldiers who rebelled in Unity State told the Sudan Tribune that Aguirre's comments were, quote, propaganda, unquote, and dismissed the latter claims that the FPLA had retaken Mayum or was marching on to Bentiu. Quote, I just talked with people on the ground, and they told me that forces loyal to Salva Kiir attempted to launch an attack near Mayum, hoping to take it, but it was contained. That attempt is no longer a threat to our people and the state administration, unquote, said the official who preferred anonymity. Quote, everything is running normally. The market is presently operating as usual, unquote, he added. On December the 21st, the commander of the FPLA's 4th Division in Unity State, James Kaung, announced that he had rebelled against Kiir's government, declaring that he was the state's new governor. He has since appointed a new administration. Representatives from both sides of the conflict have arrived in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, for peace talks and are expected to begin negotiations mediated by regional leaders from the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, IGAD. The United Nations says that at least 1,000 people have died and around 200,000 have been displaced by the conflict as thousands of civilians have sought shelter in United Nations bases. And finally, in regard to the developments in the Republic of South Sudan, the three-week-old rebellion on the part of supporters of Riek Machar said that they were advancing on the capital of Juba as fighting between rival politicians intensifies even further. Others have speculated that the Dinka elements were planning to arrest former Vice President Riek Machar after disarming their counterparts from the newer ethnic group to which Machar belongs. Of course, this may have been the spark that set off the fighting on December the 15th when presidential guard units clashed. The former Minister of Education, Peter Awuk Nyaba, said the violence started when elements from the presidential guards of the Dinka ethnicity attempted to rearm after they were disarmed together with the newer colleagues, prompting suspicions and misunderstandings. The fighting then pitted the Dinka to President Salva Kiir and the newer loyal to Machar and spread further along tribal lines when civilians were first targeted in Juba based upon their ethnic backgrounds. The violence also spread to other parts of the country, with the rebels now controlling much of the oil-rich northern parts of the new nation. After recapturing the strategic town of Bor, the capital of the largest state in the country, which is about 200 kilometers from Juba, Machar said on January the 3rd to the Sudan Tribune by telephone that his forces were marching towards Juba and will capture it soon. Quote, today our forces crushed the amassed government soldiers at their stronghold in Jamisa on the Juba Road. Our troops broke their stronghold and are pursuing them as they flee back to Juba. Juba will fall soon, unquote, he confidently warned. The news about the rebels' advance towards Juba caused a tremendous amount of panic in the capital of the Republic of South Sudan. The United States on January the 3rd ordered its embassy personnel in South Sudan to leave the country in the wake of the deteriorating security situation. Quote, on January 3rd, 2014, there will be an evacuation flight arranged by the Department of State to the nearest safe haven country, unquote, partly read an emergency statement that was issued by the U.S. State Department. However, the government's army, the FPLA spokesperson, Philip Aguirre, said the government forces were instead moving to recapture Bor from the followers of Riek Machar. Quote, we have enough forces to recapture Bor. We will take it in the next 24 hours, unquote. Aguirre, however, warned the media not to broadcast news about the so-called rebel advance, saying this would cause panic among the population in the capital. But the government sources quietly admitted to Sudan Tribune that the so-called rebels, the followers of Riek Machar, were truly advancing, adding that it was not, however, in the interest of the government to tell the truth about the actual military situation on the ground. Quote, of course, today, Juba Bor Road, they have crushed the forces we mobilized to retake Bor. It was a disaster, but we will deploy again, unquote, said the source that spoke on the condition of anonymity. He further explained that they lost several tanks and artillery weapons. He also said the government's forces lost some senior military officers, which he did not want to name, when they fell into an ambush laid by the followers of Riek Machar. The retreating troops combined with Ugandan forces, he revealed, were under the command of the Deputy Chief of Staff of Operations, Lieutenant General Malwal Hayoum, adding that the Chief of General Staff, General James Huth Mai, was prepared to personally command the next battle against the rebels as they advanced towards the capital of Juba. The United Nations mission in South Sudan, UNMISS, said on Friday, January the 3rd, also confirmed that the fighting was going on and was heading towards the capital of Juba. Colonel Mike Shadrick of the United Nations mission in South Sudan in Bor told the international media that he independently verified that two armed groups were fighting about 40 miles away on the Juba-Bor road. The situation was calm in Bor town, he said, which remained under the control of the ousted vice presidential forces of Riek Machar. A commander, Brigadier General Kor Chol, who is working with Riek Machar, who took part in the fighting engagement on January the 3rd, also said the government soldiers were retreating back to the capital of Juba and will not be able to stop them from advancing in on Juba. Quote, "We are currently pursuing pro-Salva Kiir soldiers. We are surely matching and will enter Juba very soon," unquote. He added the government was not telling the truth to the citizens about, quote, "what is actually taking place on the ground and the battlefields," unquote, and that government spokespersons employed, quote, "propaganda of lies with the aim to deceive the public," unquote. He described Aguirre's claim of trying to attack Bentiu and Unity State as, quote, "a mere propaganda," unquote, and a desperate attempt to raise the morale of the, quote, "demoralized," unquote, governor troops. Kor cautioned the residents of Juba to stay indoors or seek refuge with the United Nations mission in South Sudan as the rebels would storm the capital, quote, "any time soon," unquote. And that was an update on developments taking place inside the Republic of South Sudan, where a split between followers of President Salva Kiir and the ousted Vice President Riek Machar has resulted in heavy clashes in at least four regions throughout the new South Sudanese state. And we'll be right back in a minute to discuss developments that have been taking place inside the city of Detroit.
And you're listening to Pan-African Journal with Abiyomi Azikwe on cprmetro.org.
And welcome back. Inside the city of Detroit, even though on December 3rd, Judge Stephen Rhodes, the federal judge who is overseeing the bankruptcy inside the city, has, of course, been hearing a trial surrounding whether or not the taxpayers of the city of Detroit will have to pay off high interest and, in fact, a fraudulent swap deal that was signed by a previous administration in 2005 and also renewed in 2009. There was, of course, a trial that took place beginning on December 17th. The trial to determine whether or not the city will be strapped with this deal continued on January the 3rd. The trial was stopped on December 18th as a result of the questioning of Attorney Jerome Gerber related to the character of the swap deal. The Barclays Bank is offering to loan the city of Detroit some $350 million in order to terminate these swap deals with the Bank of America and the United Bank of Switzerland, banks that have been heavily implicated in the so-called subprime mortgage scandal. At the bankruptcy hearing on Friday, January the 3rd, emergency manager Kevin Orr admitted that the city of Detroit could have pursued claims for fraud, unjust enrichment, and breach of contract against Bank of America and UBS to potentially recover $300 million these banks have already netted from the interest rate swap swindle. However, instead of going after these banks for their predatory lending practices, which caused Detroit's financial crisis by foreclosing on 100,000 homes in the city over a period of 3 years in the last decade, as a result of the impact of these fraudulent credit default swaps, or asking Judge Rhodes now to approve and up to 8.5% interest with a $4.2 million breakage fees. If the deal is approved, the people of Detroit will be paying 20% of the city income tax revenue, that is $48 million a year, to these banks for the next 4 years at the expense of city pensions, jobs, and services. Of course, the hearing is going to resume on Tuesday, January the 7th. It was scheduled to resume on January the 6th. However, as a result of the inclement weather, it has been postponed for 1 day. The Moratorium Now Coalition, which has been opposing the imposed imposition of the emergency management as well as the bankruptcy and now this egregious swap deal, is encouraging people in the city of Detroit to pack the hearing on Tuesday morning beginning at 9 a.m. The Moratorium Now Coalition is saying, let's send a message to Judge Rhodes to reject this gift to the banks. The Moratorium Now Coalition is calling for the cancellation of the debt to the banks that has strangled the city of Detroit for many years now. The Moratorium Now Coalition says the banks owe us for the destruction they have caused. They're calling for the banks to pay for the reconstruction of the city of Detroit and to the communities in which they are so responsible for their destruction. And with that, we're going to conclude this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal. And in concluding this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal, we'd like to recap the stories covered this week in the Pan-African Journal. The neocolonial regime in the North African state of Libya is saying that it is resuming production of oil despite a continuing blockade of the drilling and distribution centers inside that petroleum-rich country. Meanwhile, the bodies of a New Zealander and a Briton have been discovered inside the country, which has been experiencing chaos and underdevelopment since the imperialist war regime change nearly 3 years ago. A new survey has revealed that most people around the world view United States imperialism as a major threat to world peace. The Pentagon and the Central Intelligence Agency is engaging in massive bombing and destabilization efforts across the entire planet. A South Sudanese general has been killed in an ambush outside the capital of Jonglei State at Bor. Meanwhile, negotiations are underway in Ethiopia between followers of President Salva Kiir and the ousted Vice President Riek Machar. Fighting has intensified inside the country over the last several days. And the city of Detroit is facing the potential of another imposition of an unsustainable financial deal with the making good of a swap, interest rate swap deal from 2005. The trial resumes in this particular regard on Tuesday, January the 7th. And with that, this is Abayomi Ezekwe. We'd like to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire, which the Pan-African Journal is largely based upon, is an international electronic press service designed to foster intelligent discussion on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998 and has published thousands of articles and dispatches in newspapers, in magazines, in journals, and research reports on blogs and on websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. And if you want to log on to the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, just log on to panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. This is Abayomi Ezekwe signing off, and have a beautiful week.
Once again, this is Abayomi Ezekwe, and welcome back to the Pan-African Journal for this week. We just heard the New York City version of the Pan-African Journal from January the 6th, earlier this year, 2014. Right now, we'll be signing off for the Pan-African Journal for this week. If you want to have access to this program as well as other archive programs of the Pan-African Journal, just log on to blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. This is Abayomi Ezekwe signing off, and have a beautiful week.
I love and I love the life we live.